Welcome to Disc Golf History and Legends, sponsored by Blue Power Disc Golf. And here is your host, Scott Stokely.
Hey, everyone. So right off the bat, this is going to be a little bit of a surprise because we're going to be doing things a little differently than planned. When I came up with the idea of doing this podcast, I toyed with the idea of recording it and releasing a tape version with editing out every time I'm, said something stupid or technical difficulties, or I could do it live and allow people to chat and talk about this during the show. And I went with live, but there's a trade-off, and the trade-off is unforeseen things happen. And this is going to be one of those times, but do not tune out because this is the definition of a blessing in disguise. You guys are going to be so psyched. The plan is to do a history of disc golf in Washington, and we're having some technical difficulties, and we only have one of the guests on the show, and the guest is one of the, by definition, legends of the sport of Frisbee, Cheryl Newland from Washington. Now, instead of trying to do a Washington State podcast with one person, which I feel would be failing the show in Washington, I'm going to reschedule, and we're going to do the Washington History of Disc Golf in Washington next Wednesday. And that way we'll get Marty on and hopefully Lowell, and we're going to, it's going to be great about the history of disc golf in Washington. But tonight we're going to do the first of the Legends series. There's going to be a whole lot of legends, you know, from John Kirkland to Dan Roddick. And this is going to be our first legend episode with Cheryl Newland. She was literally there at the beginning. Don't tune out. She's from Washington. A lot of this will be about Washington. So we're going to get to that in just a minute. So the first thing I need to share before we get there is the ulterior motive for doing these podcasts is that, the original idea is that I'm running a series of 10 PDGA Blue Power Disc Golf tournaments, and I'm running four around the Northwest in July. They're going to be in Twin Falls, Idaho, June 30th, July 1st, and then on consecutive weekends, Newburgh, Oregon, Cedro Woolley, Washington, and then Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. And the details you can find. The only thing I want you to know about these is they are traditional disc golf tournaments. So if you want to come out and just play a PDGA disc golf tournament, they're both one-day tournaments based on division. Come on out. 100% payback in cash for pros, 100% payback in prizes for AMs, trophies, CTPs, ace pools. They're tournaments. However, the Blue Power part of this is on the Saturday of every event, there's going to be a free disc golf class for anyone with special needs. That's what Blue Power is about. So if you know anybody in any of these areas with autism or Down syndrome or blind, paraplegic, CP, kid or adult, bring them out Saturday. Every special needs player who comes out is going to the class is going to get a free golf disc just for coming out. And the final plug before I get to the part you guys really want to see, you know, we have a bunch of great sponsors for this series. Dynamic Discs stepped up huge. Disc Mania is on board. They're brilliant, fantastic. Eagle Throws Disc Mania. Great companies. Gateway's also on board. And I want you guys to see one of the things we're going to be doing to help raise money for the tour is that I'm selling sets of 5 or 10 Blue Power Wizards. I'm selling them sets of 5 or 10 because if you get a putter, you can't just have one. You need a training disc. So you can buy 5 of these Blue Power Wizards for $50, or you can buy 10 for $90. Just message me, and I'll get those to you. We'll have a store up soon. Okay, enough about that. This is, I can't even begin to tell you how excited I am. Can we bring Cheryl on? And then I'm going to give a quick backstory, and then we'll get started. Hi, Cheryl.
Hi.
Okay. Hello. So I'm going to set the stage, and then you could correct me if I'm wrong, because I wasn't there, but I want everybody to kind of understand the origins of where you came from. So, back, years and years ago, when they invented injection molding, companies made these flying discs like the Pipco Little Abner or the Space Saucer. And then, Whammo put flying discs on the map by making the Frisbee. And over time, a little tiny, wasn't even really a sport at the beginning, but the games, the Frisbee games started popping up. Now, this is pre-internet. Certainly, there was no mass media attention, and there weren't any organizations on board at the beginning. So what happened is, all over the world, but especially around the U.S., little pockets of people who like playing Frisbee popped up all over the place. Now, these are little islands, and from all the stories I've ever heard, on most of these little islands of 3, 4, 6 players in a town that played Frisbee, they didn't even know people were taking Frisbee serious elsewhere. And all of a sudden the games started coming out and they started inventing games. Well, who could throw it the farthest? Who could throw it up in the air the longest and catch it? And then let's adapt a game of football with Frisbees. And but the sport was called Frisbee. And you played, you didn't play Frisbee golf. You didn't play, all, like you played Frisbee. And next thing you know, tournaments started forming here and there. And then newsletters started coming out. And it's like, this is the same way bands communicated back then. You would join the International Frisbee Association, for example, and you would get on this mailing list. And all you would do is you would see, you'd be like one part of the country and you would see the results that 2,000 miles away, some guy won a tournament for the third time in a row and he became a legend, but no one ever knew, met that person. And like, it was so isolated. But next thing you know, the sport of Frisbee kept growing and these little pockets started coming together. Well, in one of those pockets was in the Pacific Northwest. There was a player by the name of Doug Newland, who was one of the first seven members of the PDGA Disc Golf Hall of Fame, and his wife, Cheryl. Now, they were there literally at the beginning of the sport of Frisbee, basically starting in the mid-70s. And Cheryl was there for it. And we're going to talk to her. Oh, this is like, I'm sorry, I'm just nerding out here. When I was growing up in the early 80s playing Frisbee, I had my heroes the way every kid had their sports heroes. Well, my sports heroes were people like Doug Newland and John Kirkland and Scott Zimmerman. Like, those are my heroes. And Cheryl's in that group. And so, Cheryl, that was way longer than people probably wanted to hear, but I'm excited. And I talk a lot when I'm excited. Cheryl, welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you, Scott. It's my pleasure and my honor. Yeah, you have a lot of political
first legend.
Oh, okay. Well, let's see. First I'll talk about Doug. Doug started playing Frisbee before I did. His father bought him a blue Pluto platter in the late 50s. And he was the oldest of three. So he played with that Frisbee and he must have just got super excited because it became his favorite thing. And then his younger brother, who was five or six years younger, also played, and he played on the circuit. And in fact, I just saw him the other night. But we would, you know, so Doug really started young. I did not. My grandparents had a roller skating rink and my mother was a speed skating champion and I trained and I was a rink rat. And then I was in baseball and a whole lot of other sports that, I mean, like seven of them or something. So I came to Frisbee in college, which was in 1973, at the University of Washington in Seattle. And Doug had gone to college. He was older than I was. He'd gone in Colorado College in your state. And that's where he met Joe Fight. Joe Fight and him were good college buddies. But Joe didn't catch the bug yet. I don't know why. But so Doug had rode his bike that summer from Seattle to San Francisco. Then he got a ride to Denver and he rode up to Montana and then came home to Seattle and then started school at the University of Washington. And I met him the next, you know, the very first day of school. We had a class together and our class was geology field course. So every weekend we went out all around the state to learn about geology in our state. And so we didn't meet during the week and we didn't have tests. We just went on field trips every weekend. And Doug always had a Frisbee with him. And he and a couple other people were always playing Frisbee wherever we went. And I thought, well, if I'm, you know, I really like him. And if I'm going to have him notice me, I better learn how to throw this thing because I sucked at it. And I would try and join them. And they would like, oh, God, can she go away? You know, every time I threw it, it'd go way far away. So I thought, what is wrong? Why can't I throw this piece of plastic? You know, I can do everything else. So I quickly learned because I had to. It's a lot like a volleyball spike. It's a wrist snap. So I learned you do that in Frisbee, only it's sideways. and you can control the Frisbee that way. So I quickly learned how to play, and then I came back and played with him, and he was impressed that I had learned how to play. And so that's the start of our relationship. And it wasn't that long after where he got a black lab that his uncle gave him, pick of the litter. So he picked his dog and named him Luxor, and he became a Frisbee dog champion. And he was a regional champion and went to the Rose Bowl. And so Doug, after college, well, I mean, this is in the mid 70s, you know, I mean, I have to set the stage. SNL had just started, you know, the first season, the first original SNL crew, who I think are the best still to this day. You know, that was what we all watched every Saturday night. And, you know, we partied on the weekends and went to school during the week. And it was the 70s, and times were a lot different. And yeah, there was no internet. And, you know, there was a lot of, you know, smoking pot and bud. And but it wasn't the kind of bud that's out now. That's all like crazy psychedelic stuff. So it was Humboldt Bud. In fact, there was an Ultimate Team called Humboldt Buds. But did you ever see their disc? It was great. So no. Humboldt Bud is mellow, and you laugh and giggle, and you know, eat everything in sight, and then you mellow out and you play Frisbee. And so we would play Frisbee golf on campus at the UW in between our classes, going to the next class. We would just pick objects like a light pole or a garbage can, you know, from here's the tee, and then, you know, count your throws. And we called it FALF because it was Frisbee golf. And we didn't know what else to call it. So that's how we started playing. Now, Doug was really into distance. I guess you were too. So there's a place in the middle of campus called Red Square. And it's where there's five buildings. And then where the buildings come in, there's walkways. And so the wind comes in all five different directions. And it's a whole brick, large area. And so there's a kind of like a stage and some steps. And Doug would throw off of those the stage there and try and hit the administration building, which was really far away. And he never made it, but that was his goal. That's how he tried to increase his distance all the time. So, you know, every quarter we had different golf holes because we had different classes, and we'd always, you know, we didn't have cell phones. We didn't text each other. We couldn't say, meet me at this place. So communication was really different. So, you know, that's the start of our golf life. And then one day we were sitting there in Red Square throwing distance, and this little old hippie dude walks up from one of the walkways. And he's wearing shorts and tennis shoes and a headband, and he's got long hair and a beard, and he's talking California Beach hippie jibe. And we're like, who the hell is that guy? And he's wearing a Frisbee t-shirt. It was the 1975 Rose Bowl shirt. Excuse me. And we're like, who's this guy? And so he comes up and goes, hey, you know, can we jam and stuff? And he's tipping the disc, and we've never seen anyone do that. And he's doing some freestyle things, which we haven't really seen either. And so that's the first time we met Ralph Williamson, who is another legend.
Wow,
you know,
really?
So, oh, yeah, yeah. Ralph, I mean, I guess you could say, I don't know where Ralph was born and where he was raised. I just never asked him that. I never knew. I think if I had to guess, I'd say he's from California, but I really don't know. But okay. He came to work at Boeing, which, you know, he was a technical writer. That's what he did on his day job. And then he was a Frisbee freak, you know, like big time. So he just, you know, hey, man, I just got back from the Rose Bowl. And we're like, what's the Rose Bowl? We didn't know anything about it. Now, Doug did have an IFA T-shirt because he wore it all the time. So he knew about the IFA, but we weren't members yet or anything. So Ralph kind of introduced us to that whole beginning of the tournament scene. Because he was at the, you know, 75 Rose Bowl. I don't know if he was at a seven. Was there one in 74 maybe? I'm not sure. But so Doug, I think, went in 76. And I didn't go till 77 and 78. But I mean, I toured around the tournaments. We went together, a lot of us. Ralph would drive sometimes, and there'd be six or eight of us in his van, and we'd go down to California. We know every rest stop both ways, you know, between here and San Diego.
Okay, so I want to jump in for a second. Sure. So I don't want to gloss over something because people don't understand, but back in the 70s, something you mentioned is that Frisbee dogs was as much of a respected division or category of Frisbee player as anything, right?
Yeah. I mean, it was big in our area anyway.
Well, but what was really interesting back then, and this is what would frustrate the heck out of us by the 80s, is that when you ran a Frisbee tournament, if 100 people came out to watch the Frisbee tournament, 95 of them were there to watch the dogs.
Right. That's true.
And when you mentioned later on, all the way through the 80s, that you played Frisbee or played disc golf, the question would always be about the dogs. So, but Newland had a dog. You guys had a champion dog, right?
Yeah. Well, we had two of them. Doug had Luxor, who was probably the most amazing dog I've ever known in my whole life. We were both third generation black lab owners in our family. So that was our favorite breed. And Doug got this amazing dog and trained him to be a Frisbee dog. You know, he could run, catch, jump, whatever. I mean, the dog was really, he was really quite good. You know, and we saw, you know, Ashley Whippet, and we knew Hank. I think there was another dog. Yeah. Anyway, we knew the first few dogs that were famous for Frisbee stuff. And up in the Northwest, it was Luxor won the regional tournament, the very first one. When they first started state championships at WAMO, it was 1976, and ours was maybe the first, I'm not sure. But a woman from a local radio station, her name was Shelley Morrison, which I don't think she's related to the Morrison that worked at WAMO, I'm not sure. But okay. She put on the first state tournament, and it had a dog event, and that's why there was a million people. And she was a radio phenom, yeah. And so, you know, on the our favorite rock station, it was called Kazam at the time, and she was great. Anyway, she put on this whole tournament, and Ralph and Jeff Jorgensen were there, and Doug and I, and you know. It's the first overall tournament, right? And it's at Lower Woodland at Green Lake, which is in Seattle. And that's primarily been the main area where Frisbee still exists. I mean, it started there and it still exists. And the freestylers play there all the time, almost every night, especially during summer. Our ultimate team started there with Bill Nye, the science guy. He was our coach. And he had just come from Cornell to work at Boeing also. And Doug had heard about Ultimate, you know, back east, but nobody had played it. We didn't know how to play. So he hooked up Bill and said, come on, we're going to meet at Green Lake. I'll bring the people and you're going to start coaching us. And so we all showed up and we didn't have enough for a team. And the freestylers were on the other side of the swimming pool. So Doug says, just a minute. And he goes over and he convinces several of them to come over. And they joined the team and Bill became our coach and we had a team. And then we had a meeting.
Wait, Bill Nye, the science guy, was your coach?
Yes. And there's things about Bill. Yeah, I know. I think the PDGA, so a woman did an article about him several years ago. Look it up.
Okay.
Bill Nye had come just from college, and I don't know what he did at Boeing, but, you know, he was a science dude. But he was quite a comic. He was hilarious. And he showed up to teach us how to play Ultimate. Okay, he was a Steve Martin imitator. He was awesome at it. He could imitate Steve Martin better than anybody I know. He just didn't look like him. So he came to the game with an arrow through the head. You know, you wear it and it looks like a bow and arrow is shot through his skull. And so it's hard to take someone serious when they're wearing this, you know, they're trying to teach us, okay, about Ultimate and how to play. So yeah, he was our coach. So we formed a club. We had a meeting at Ralph Williamson's house, and Doug became voted in as the president, and I was the secretary. And we're called the Olympic Windjammers. And I was the only woman that played on the Ultimate team. And I'm not known for my running, but I'm good at throwing and catching. And when you're 4'11", nobody, I mean, come on, what guy's going to take you serious? They're not going to pay attention. So, I did pretty well in Ultimate because nobody was guarding me. And, so anyway, he became our coach, and we ended up going to the Western Nationals several times and doing quite well. Now, unfortunately, we don't have a lot of photos because back in the 70s, we had really crappy cameras. We didn't have digital cell phones. We had Kodak Instamatic and Polaroids, which sucked. So we don't have a whole lot of cool photos to show people. You know, I think I have one photo of our Ultimate team, but I'm not in it because I'm taking the picture. So that's kind of a bummer. I don't have a picture of me on the team. But I know my friends know that I was on the team. So we would do halftime shows in the kingdom for the Seattle Sounders Soccer Club. And they loved us there because it was like watching soccer with a Frisbee. And they thought it was so cool. And then we brought the dogs, and, you know, when they'd catch it, they'd scream and yell. But they really liked the Ultimate, right? So I have one story about that that was my favorite when we did one of the demos there. Because nobody, you know, we were playing two teams scrimmaging. Bill and I were in there, and nobody was paying attention to me. And I zipped down into the end zone. And there's a turnover, and they see me down there in the end zone, and the crowd is screaming. And this guy, whoever it was, threw a long bomb to me, only it hovered, and it gave everybody time to get down to it. So I was surrounded by men that were way taller than me. And they all jumped up into the air to catch this disc in the end zone, and they timed it wrong. And they missed it, and they were coming down. I shot up in the middle, and I plucked the disc out of the air. And the place went crazy in the kingdom because they all saw what was going on from a distance, and they can't believe that I came down with the disc. And and Bill Nye, I remember Bill Nye and all these other guys look at me and go, "How did you do that?" And I said, "Timing, because you all wanted it too bad and you jumped too soon."
That's funny.
But that was like my favorite Ultimate moment. It was really fun.
I want to backtrack to the golf tournament real quick. So you mentioned six or eight of you got into a van and drove from Washington to California on multiple occasions.
Oh, all the time for years and years.
Was it, and this is so cliche, was it a VW bus?
Some weren't a VW. I don't know what brand it was, but I think the first ones were, yeah. I mean, Tom Baudet in California had the famous VW van.
What were the tournaments like back then? Because I want to try to paint a picture for mean, tournaments are so awesome and professional. And I mean, go to the Beaver State Fling and you see the most professional tournament you'll ever go to. But it wasn't like
that. let's backtrack to the Washington State first overall tournament where the dogs were, and we had a lot of people. It was on TV. You know, Doug really knew how to run a tournament. He didn't run that one, but he ran the next one and the ones after that. And he did all the PR, newspaper stuff. Doug was a really good writer. So he just went with it. But I became the first overall women's champion. Unfortunately, Doug did not. He didn't win golf. Someone else you probably have heard of did. Steve Slazer. You know Steve? Okay. Steve, he was from Florida. But his mother lived in the town where I live now. And he was up visiting his mother, and there was this tournament. And so he was a real nerd back then. Real computer, you know, nerd type guy. He was not an athlete. I would not say that about him. He looked like he worked at IBM, like with a pocket protector. And he showed up quiet as a mouse and won Frisbee Golf. And won I think he won the overall. And nobody knew who he was. He hadn't been anywhere local because he was just visiting. So, you know, Doug, rather than being upset that he didn't win it, he became friends with Steve. And he kind of coached him and helped him. And then Steve ended up living here for a while. And they had a great friendship. But see, back in the day, you weren't competitive. Like, you weren't trying to, you know, to beat everybody else. It was fun. Tournaments were fun. It was the hippie times. Hippie dippy, right. You know? Right. So you had nice music at the concerts. They were outdoors. It was just real laid back. Tournament directors were laid back. They were still trying to figure out how to do things. So sometimes there were problems because, you know, they couldn't figure out how to measure distance right or whatever, or other events or something like that. But, you know, but Doug would always try to step in and help. And so then I got a job in Eugene, Oregon, in the summer of 76. So I worked at Outward Bound Mountaineering Company. And Doug said, well, hey, I'm going to go to the Boulder tournament. It's a big tournament. And meet me there. You have to train. You know, they have these events. We didn't know what they were. MTA. Like, what? Okay, well, you got to get a fastback. So I got a fastback, but it wasn't the right kind. It was the classic fastback that was yellow with a black band. It wasn't the kind of fastback like an FB3 like they were using. And all I knew is you had to throw it up in the air and catch your own throw. I didn't know how. I'd never seen anyone do it. So I had to just make it up as I went. Well, you know, so I ended up flying to the tournament and I met Doug. He had driven there, I think, and he had his dog. And so we were on the golf course. And it was at the university in Boulder. And it was a really nice natural object course. There was no disc bowls yet. You know, they didn't exist. And I don't think we had played posts yet either. It was just, you know, you went off the top of a building on campus and teed off to try to hit something. And then there was a map. You had a scorecard and you kind of knew where it was, but you really had to play it several times with someone who knew it before the tournament, or you would get lost and you would get messed up because there weren't any directions like that way to the next tee or anything, you know? So we were practicing with these two guys and they were really funny. It was like Mutt and Jeff. One was really tall and skinny. One wasn't. And we had the dog. And if you knew anything about Luxor, he liked sticks, and the bigger the better. So he'd grab a stick and then he'd find a bigger one and drop it and get the bigger one. Well, these guys started noticing, and they were laughing, and because he got these huge sticks, and they said, "Well, how big a stick is this dog going to get? And you know, will he take a live tree out of the ground?" And Doug said, "I don't know. We'll see." And he pointed to a tree that was probably 7 or 8 inches, you know, diameter. And he said, "Luxor, tree, get it." And the dog went flying through the air horizontal, grabbed the tree, and instantly started to pull it out of the ground. And they were laughing at the dog. They're like, "That dog's crazy." You know, and so we left, and Luxor kept working on that tree. Well, and we've gone 2 more golf holes, and the guy's going to Doug, like, "Aren't you worried about your dog? He's still way back there." And, you know, and he goes, "No, he'll find me. He knows where I am." And, you know, a couple more holes. "Hey, where's your dog?" And he goes, "He's trying to get that tree out of the ground." And they're like, "No way. He won't do it." Well, all of a sudden you hear this crashing through the bushes in the woods. And Luxor had pulled the tree out of the ground and was dragging it. And these guys couldn't believe it. They were like, I mean, it was another time. So anyway,
yeah.
So it was the first big tournament that I had been to. So I had only looked at some Frisbee World magazines and seen these names of people and pictures, you know, because we didn't have the internet. And so there was like Monica Liu was the first women's overall Frisbee champion. There was Joe Cahow. Mm-hmm. She worked at WAMO, you know, at IFA. There was Stork. Mm-hmm. There was, you know, all these people. And there are pictures of them. And so you're like, wow, you know, these people were like famous to me, right? I knew who they were. They didn't know who I was. So I show up at the tournament and, you know, and I meet them and I'm like starstruck, like, you know, like you probably were. And I'm really excited. I think I'm going to do well in golf. And instead, I totally choke and I bombed out and I got last place. I was very embarrassed. And I was that night sitting at the awards ceremony where they hand out all the trophies for everything. And they always had the best trophies at Boulder, I'm telling you. They were nice. And I'm sitting there with Monica Liu feeling bad about how I did. And she goes, "You know, it's just one tournament." And I said, "Yeah, but I had been practicing all summer." You know? And I didn't exactly do myself any justice. I didn't conquer. And I said, I got last place. And I said, I'm going to come back next year and I'm going to win. And she goes, "Okay." And so I did. I came back the next year and I won first place in golf, in women's golf. So I felt really good then. You know, that was the first time I had won at a big tournament. But, you know, and I did all these other state tournaments in between. And then we'd get in Ralphie's van and we'd go down to, well, the first tournament of the year was LA and then Santa Barbara. And I had never been to Santa Barbara. If I had ever been there before, I would have gone to college there. That would have been awesome. That was so pretty. And it was just, you know, I saw Michelle Pozzoli and Cindy Burch, and they were amazing freestylists, and Tom Kennedy and Tom Shepard and Tom Baudet. I mean, all, you know, all the people, I can't even name all of them, you know, because I don't want to leave anybody out. I met Tita Ugalde. It was just really fun. The tournaments were fun. You got to see amazing.
Something you mentioned that I want to touch on is that the reason why someone could go finish last place and come finish first place the next year is because you're talented, athletic, and trained hard, but also because the sport was so new. It wasn't like everybody else had been playing for 20 years. And you'd been playing for a year, right? It was brand new to everybody. Yeah. And so what happened back then is everybody No one taught anybody how to do anything. So independently, people learned the X step all over the country, independent. People learned how to throw sidearm. They invented the sidearm all over the country. Well, in fact, the game of disc golf was invented all over the world independently. No idea who first came up with the game. But
right. So, I mean,
this is all, you guys are like making it up.
When you don't know what an event looks like, you have to, you all you can do is imagine. There's no video for you to watch. They didn't exist. We didn't even have camcorders.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm saying in college, I couldn't use a calculator in chemistry. I had to use a slide rule. Okay. Because they felt if we were using a calculator, we were cheating.
Right.
I mean, that's where, that's what it was like in college, you know? And so in the real world, yeah, communication was very slow and it had to be person to person contact, really.
Yeah.
You know, like meeting Ralph and seeing Ralph tip it and kick it with his toe. Well, you know, we could catch a frisbee between our legs or behind our back. But we'd never seen anyone kick it before or tip it. And then all of a sudden, everyone's tipping and kicking. You know, and then I remember when nail delays were first, they were like, happened on both coasts at the same time. People started doing nail delays. And then, I mean, everything just blossoms, you know, the way, like you said, all around the world at the same time. I don't know how that happens. It just does.
Yeah. Okay, so... Well, now let's talk about a little bit back in Washington. We'll go into more detail next week. But so
okay.
there were no permanent basket courses at this time, but there were permanent, at some point someone started putting posts in the ground and making a permanent golf course. Like
not for a long time. Doug would study Arnold Palmer's golf courses that he designed, and he would study them and learn how he made each hole and why. And so he designed the first Frisbee golf course in Seattle at Lower Woodland Park that we used at our North American Series meets. And I mean, to this day, it's probably still my favorite course, even though some holes are changed and different. It was a beautiful course, and a lot of players on the circuit, when they came to play it, even Kirkland said it was really nice. He really liked it, and other people did too. And it was, Stork had a picture of it in his office, a big poster that Doug had sent him. It was a beautiful course. And so that's where we played, and it was trees. Doug every weekend would go with orange or red tape and mark the trees, a top and a bottom, so there was a ring. And that's how you had to get, you could touch the tape or in between, and that's how you hold out. And you had a tee area, and we had golf cards and, you know, the whole tournament thing, and it worked. I don't know. And everybody kept doing that course. The very first, I don't remember any course being poles in Seattle. But the very first disc pole hole course was only 9 holes, and it was in North Seattle, and it was called North Park. And now I think it's called Mineral Springs. But it's a real short, small finesse course with a lot of out of bounds areas that are not nice to discs and stuff. But that was our first pole hole in Seattle. Now, the first, pay for play course, Doug and Tom Lander were the course pros for it. And it was in Tacoma, Washington. It was called Bob's Disc Golf. I think I sent you a picture.
Yeah, and that was the first pay-to-play course in the world, possibly, right?
Well, or in the United States, I think probably the world. I can't imagine it being anywhere else because they didn't have pole holes then anywhere, but in the U.S., right? And so, because Ed, and so it's on the back of his Hall of Fame card. It says what year he was the course pro for that. Right. Tom Lander lived at our house with us. He designed his Mini Sport Pro.
Really?
And he, he was a tool and die guy in a company that did those. And so he made his own equipment and he made his own minis. And a lot of businesses bought them as calling cards, like the Whammo ones and everything. And they were really nice and they flew really nice. And that was, I think, before Discraft started doing stuff. I mean, back in the day, it was all Whammo, right? Because Whammo did the promotions. Right. They did the Rose Bowl, and they did all the discs, and they did the TV commercials and the games and the hula hoops and everything. So everything at these tournaments, you had to use a Whammo disc. You couldn't use a CPI, which a lot of players wanted to use because they flew better. So Whammo bought the company out and then didn't let them make them anymore. So, you know, there's a lot of political stuff going on back in the day that y'all didn't know about. So we used to go to Minneapolis to the factory and talk to the lady that worked there, and she'd give us all these old CPIs and teach us all about them. And I know Tom McCran loves CPIs, and Doug liked the giant saucer tossers. He used to use them in golf. But
wait, that mean like the giant ones?
Yeah. He was good at throwing those. And he threw them for the dog. I have a story. Coming home from Boulder, we drove over Independence Pass, which is the highest pass in Colorado with the road. Mm-hmm. I think it's 10,000 feet. And so we all stopped and got out. I think Pete Boost was with us. You know Pete. And
of course.
Doug got out his giant saucer tosser and just chucked it way out there. And it towered in the air about 7 times, and then it just took off and went down the valley. And when it lost its spin, it started tumbling end over end, and then it would warp and do weird shapes, and it went wacko, and it was like really weird. You know, and then we lost track of it. And so we drove down the other side of the pass. And dang, if Doug didn't find it out in a field and he went and got it.
Really?
This is like 8,000 feet down later, you know, he got it.
Yeah.
But I've never seen a disc warp and become not a Frisbee shape. You know, it was really weird. So anyway, that's a weird story. Tangent. But
I have a question.
You
mentioned, go ahead.
Well, we have a delay. We're talking about going to tournaments and stuff and up and down the West Coast, right?
Okay.
Well, Seattle, you know, at one point didn't have a North American series. We weren't on the map yet. It was mostly California, the Midwest, and the East Coast. And so Doug wanted to get Frisbee golf and Frisbee more in the Northwest. So he started talking to people all over the state and all over Oregon and British Columbia and eventually got to be the regional director for the Pacific Northwest. So that was what he really wanted to do. And then he could promote it a lot. And so he was the main, Ralph and Jeff would get freestyle gigs at, you know, sports venues and stuff, like for the Sonic halftime show. And then they started coming to Doug. Doug was like an agent for everybody. And so they'd come to Doug and say, hey, we need a halftime show for this, for the Husky football halftime show. We want this and this and this. So Doug would set them up with whoever could come and do whatever show they wanted. And so Ralph and Jeff got a lot of show gigs from Doug, and they got them on their own. And then I was a state champion for like 5 years in a row. So all of a sudden I had an agent and I would get some gigs. But I wasn't really a freestyler. I liked golf the best.
But you did get, I do know one story, but I'll let you share it. You did get a gig at the Kingdom during a Mariners game.
Oh, yeah.
Another brush with someone famous.
Yeah. Oh, there's another story I didn't tell you about either. It was Bruce Jenner in the Kingdom. We taught him how to nail delay when he was Bruce Jenner. And now he's right? Caitlin. But he had just won the in the Olympics and everything. And he was famous. And he came to the Kingdom for something. I don't remember what. And we were there doing a show, an ultimate show. And he came down and wanted to learn what these guys were doing with their finger. And so we taught him how to nail delay. And so that was the first famous person I met with Frisbee. And then at a Mariners game, we had to bring our dogs, me and Doug. And so we did a dog demo. And Yogi Berra was coaching the Yankees at the time. And the Mariners were sucking like usual. They're not now, but this year. But they were sucking then. And so I'm accurate. And I threw the giant saucer tosser into the Yankee dugout, pretending I was throwing it for the dog. And, oh, I made a little mistake. Well, I had a Sharpie in my back pocket. So I go in and get my giant saucer tosser. They won't let me back in the locker room because there was a famous player hiding back there. And I was trying to get his autograph, but I can't remember who he was. Anyway, so I thought, okay, I'll get Yogi Berra's autograph instead. So he had his back turned towards me and he was talking to someone. And I said, "Mr. Berra, can I have your autograph, please?" And he goes, and he's turning and goes, "Oh, sure." And I hand him a giant saucer tosser and a Sharpie. And he goes, "What's this?" And I said, "It's a giant Frisbee." And he goes, "I've never signed one of these." And I said, "Well, that's okay." And he was kind of a little perturbed, but he signed it and gave it back to me. And I probably had the only Frisbee that Yogi Berra ever signed because he didn't coach too much longer after that. But that was fun. And, we had Bill Nye, the science guy. We didn't know he was going to be famous till later, but I don't know. That's kind of, well, and then in the Rose Bowl one year, I met Arnold Schwarzenegger because he was dating Laura Ingle. And that's the year she won the overall,
wait,
I think.
Wait, Arnold was dating Laura Ingle. I met Laura Ingle when I was younger. She went on to become the roadie of Oingo Boingo. You probably know that.
Yes. Right.
Yeah. And,
well,
but she was dating Arnold.
She was dating Arnold Schwarzenegger and she brought him down onto the field and he didn't have a field button. So the security kicked him out. But that's how I met Arnold. And she was really mad they kicked him out because he was famous, right? And they booted him out. And then when we were playing afterwards at Venice Beach, I met Arnold's brother, who was way better looking. And he was a bodybuilder also. But he ended up dying, I think, in a plane or a car accident or something. But then, Arnold went on and married Maria Shriver and, the rest of that. But, yeah, Laura was dating him. Okay, I have the weirdest Frisbee golf story ever that in my life, what I witnessed. And it involves Laura Ingle. Well, we were in the finals of the Rose Bowl in the golf. I don't remember what course it was. Maybe Irvine, La Mirada, whatever. And Laura was mostly a freestyler. She wasn't a golfer, but she had to learn to golf to be in the overall. So she really tried hard that year and got a lot better. So we're golfing in the same foursome. And we have pole holes, and she putts, and it hits the chains, lands in the basket. But because she's a freestyler, she put a lot of spin on it. So it lands in the basket and is spinning fast. Well, it's windy, and we're on the top of a hill. The wind comes up under the disc as it's spinning, lifts the disc up like a UFO out of the basket, and drops it on the ground. And we're watching this like what just happened? We've never seen this happen ever before. And So she goes, well, what do I do? And I said, well, you're not going to like my answer. And she goes, okay. And I said, there's no officials around. We can't stop and ask and go get one. So here's the deal. Your disc did not come to rest in the basket. It was still spinning. A natural thing of wind came and lifted it out and dropped it on the ground. You still have to putt out. So, mm-hmm. And I said, and we'll put a little asterisk on the scorecard. And we'll ask them at the end, what should we do? What, you know, because we witnessed this and it was like, it was surreal. It was like a UFO had just visited us. Because somebody reached in and grabbed it and picked it up and threw it on the ground. But we never saw anybody. And it was the weirdest frisbee golf thing I've ever experienced. So it ended up, they agreed with me that what I said was correct, that because it didn't come to rest in the basket, it wasn't done. And it went on the ground and we didn't have anything to do with it. So she had to add another, that stroke. So that was, right. I mean, that was a, have you ever heard of that or seen that happen?
No, but and a lot of players, I mean, I guess you would somewhat realize it, but these weren't golf discs.
So no, they were like plastic.
Weird things happen. Yeah, weird things happened back then. I mean, you actually could throw the disc. A frisbee that weighed 119 grams was one of the ones in your bag, even though your bag was actually a grocery sack. but that is if you carry one. But yeah, they were 119 grams, but you know, larger. So I mean, those things happened. But
yeah, I mean,
haven't
it was,
heard about it.
But that was pretty bizarre. I mean, yeah, we had 119s. I golfed with a 76 Rose Bowl disc, 119, most of my life. I still have a bunch of them, and I still prefer them. You know?
Of course.
Because I know how. You have muscle memory, and you know how to throw them. So when I went to Worlds 4 years ago, I didn't know how to throw heavy discs. I never had any. So Tita helped teach me, and she gave me a bunch of them, and I practiced, and I learned how to throw them, and I went to Worlds, and actually, I did pretty okay the first day. Second day, not so well, but there is an art to throwing it, and it's totally different muscle memory, so it's not not easy.
Back in 1983, when the beveled edge golf disc came out, there was a drop off instantly between a lot of the players very good at throwing frisbees, but didn't have the correct, that's not the correct technique at all for throwing a beveled edge heavy golf disc. And if you didn't make that transition, you dropped it worse, but your game was, there was a divide.
Right. And I don't think players now understand that. I mean, if you gave them a bunch of light plastic and said, go out and play golf with it, they would quickly learn that they would suck at it probably compared to the discs that they know, right? Because they fly totally different. Back in the 70s and 80s, you had to be a master of different throws because you had to deal with the wind and the rain and whatever else, you know? So you had to know how to do different throws. You didn't, it wasn't just a backhand and a sidearm, a roller and a upside downer. You couldn't be a good golfer knowing just four throws. Impossible. So,
one thing that people, I keep saying people don't know, but one thing about the old days was that there was no such thing as an overstable disc. Everything was understable. It was just a matter of how much understable. Right. And in fact, nothing even flew straight. And so you first had to put about twice as much spin on it, because if you didn't spin it, it became more understable and it didn't fly. So you had to learn to throw. You would curl your arm up to generate spin. You would throw less speed with more spin. And because discs were all understable, there was no throwing it. If you're right-handed throwing a backhand, you couldn't throw a disc out and then let it fall off to the left at the end of the flight. It didn't happen. You had to manipulate a whole different flight path And, you know, one of the things I want to share on this podcast is that there were some really good athletes playing back then. There weren't a whole lot of alternative sports in, you know, back in the 70s. There was frisbee, surfing, and skateboarding, and possibly skiing. But if you played sports, you looked like a sports player. You had a crew cut. You had, you know, you dressed a certain way. You were clean cut. That's what people who played sports looked like. There were plenty of people that had the same genetic gifts. And the same desire to train and compete that all the other athletes had, but they just didn't look the part. And those are the people that started skateboarding and playing frisbee. So there were great athletes back then, but they didn't pass the eyeball test. They didn't look the part. They were just as good. They just liked long hair.
Right. They had long hair, beards, which are back in popularity again, but they dabbled in marijuana, and that was looked down upon. It was illegal, you know. But yet in my high school, I remember our teacher let us, she wouldn't let us smoke in class, but she would let us brew marijuana tea, and we could have that at school.
So in high school?
That's pretty weird. Yeah. We actually had a frisbee football team in our high school, and I saw a picture in my annual. I think it was 1971. We have a picture, and I'm in the picture. So, we didn't call it ultimate. But we were alternative people in the school because the main school pep rally was happening in the gym, and we didn't go to that. We went up to the field and played frisbee football, you know, and drank marijuana tea, and we had fun. And we also were the smart kids in the school, and we were kids who were going somewhere. We were going to do something. We were going to change the world, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, we didn't want it to be like our parents' world.
No, and that is another part about that. You know, and I'm second generation. I started in 81, so I was not the Rose Bowl generation, but there was some carryover. And I say this in the most loving way, I've said this forever, is that we were misfits and we were outcasts. And the thing we had in common was frisbee. But, you know, a lot of us didn't fit in other places. I mean, we were, you know, counterculture is the word that got applied, but we were counterculture. And I think even more so in your generation of players, you know, I mean, it was the hippie movement, and if hippies wanted to play sports, they played frisbee. That was their sport.
Yeah, and so that made it difficult for Doug, who envisioned frisbee golf like it is today. He saw that in the future in the 70s, and that's what he wanted to do. But because he was counterculture looking, he would go to the parks department and talk to them, and they didn't want to have anything to do with us. Because we were hippies, you know. I mean, the whole hippie college generation in the 60s and 70s was not the same. I mean, the same as my mother grew up in the 50s. I grew up in the 60s. So we're very different, you know. So, they didn't want to have anything to do with Doug. And he persevered and he kept trying. He taught frisbee in the schools. He taught kids. He did demos at the library. He did them in the Sonics and the Kingdom and the football team. And he, you know, he did all those things. He worked with Special Olympics and the Junior Olympics and the K-9. I mean, he was the complete frisbee guy up here. When Ed started selling disc golfs, you know, the Midnight Flyers, Doug bought them and sold them to all the players. He got them out to everybody. All the best stuff, you know, he wanted them to have. I remember another weird thing that happened was I think it was John Kirkland and Cray Van Sickle maybe discovered the 360 turn for distance. Did you ever hear about that?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I'm not sure if it was those two, but I know Doug was one of the first to find out about it. And so he came back and taught Lowell and a bunch of other people who were power throwers. And they were all poor Lowell. I know. I wish Lowell had come on the show tonight. Mm-hmm. I think Lowell threw his back out doing it. And so, and Tom hurt himself too. So it quickly kind of died down. Nobody wanted to do it. But it worked at first. You did throw a little farther, but then you couldn't figure out how to make your body not fall apart afterwards. But, you know, I mean, I saw nail delays and I saw distance things and MTA. And I was there at Golden Gate Park when Victor Malafronte threw his famous sidearm. Grace Slick and Jefferson Airplane were singing in the park. And he threw a 538-foot distance throw.
Yeah, with a light plastic frisbee.
Yes.
Like a 119 or 140 or a 141, I believe.
I don't, you know, my brother-in-law was standing next to him when it happened, and I don't remember if it was what kind of disc it was, but all I remember was like a collective ooh as everybody on the field stopped and looked up and watched how this disc went, and it was in the air for quite a while, and watching how far it went. And then you could see Stork running all the way to the end because he wanted to spot it because they were going to measure it. It wasn't at an official tournament. It was a Frisbee festival, but it still went down in the books as being the longest throw at the time. And, you know, if you'd seen Victor right before, it was just a nonchalant little throw, just his little flick of the sidearm. And he just happened to nail it perfect with the wind. And it towered and towered and towered. And then it got the right angle and it just took it. And it was it was toast. It was gone. And watching Stork run.
Well, no, these are the stories. You know, 538-foot sidearm. This is the story. It's like when if you're a little boy who plays baseball, you hear about Babe Ruth calling his shot. And there's a lot of witnesses, but no picture. You know, like. It's like, but it happened. Right. It happened. Well, at least in that case, that's what they thought he was pointing at. But the thing about Victor, I grew up hearing that story. It happened. It happened for real. It was measured by pacing it off, and it wasn't at the event. But it's not something that didn't happen. Everybody knew it happened.
It happened.
1,000 people.
We all saw it. We all knew. Yeah, it happened. So, but that's the way the tournament. That's the way it was back then. You know, and I remember being at the Santa Barbara tournament and watching this young guy. I think he got the MTA world record. And I have a picture of him and he's totally in shock. He can't believe he did it. And he's probably like 18 or 19 and he's instantly mobbed at the tournament. You know, he's famous. He just got the world record. I don't remember what it was, but. You know, things like that, the world records would be broken a lot back then. I mean, the men's distance records weren't real far, right? I mean, I think Dave Johnson was the distance guy.
Oh,
was
the power Dave, guy. Yeah.
So, he was the one people would aspire to, you know. He was the guy. You know, and everybody... did kind of all events. It wasn't just, you didn't just have one specialty because in order to be in the top, you had to be an all-round person. So that's what we did.
Yeah, you had to play Frisbee. So I would be remiss if I didn't ask you about this. I happen to have noticed that you're a girl. And back in the early days, still to this day, it was a challenge, but there weren't a lot of women players back then. Or I mean, what was it like being one of the few female players in the world at that point?
Well, in Seattle, I was used to it because I was pretty much the only one for a while. And then I think Lowell's wife became a good golfer and she, you know, joined me. And some, you know, there were some freestylists that would come. And we kind of try to pull them into golf, but they didn't really want to. So it was hard. And so when I got invited, I mean, back then you had to be in the top 12 women to get invited to the Rose Bowl. So I came in and got invited and I was real excited. So I went and met all these other people. I hadn't met Gail McCall yet or Suzanne Limpert or, you know, but I had known the West Coast women already. I had been a DDC partner of Tita and Joe K. Howe. And I was friends with Michelle and Cindy. And, you know, I mean, I just knew all these women and I just felt like one of the girls. Well, it's hard to explain. Okay, when the $50,000 golf tournament happened, they didn't have a women's division. And I was not happy. I mean, this was a big deal, right? And so I sent a letter to WAMO. And I got their reply back. And they thought Frisbee golf, that men didn't have an advantage over women and they should play on an even playing field. And I said, yeah, if it's a small finesse course, I will agree with you. But if it's a distance, you know, course, we can't compete with light plastic. It's impossible. So they said they weren't going to have a women's division. Well, so then I think I called Ed Hedrick and complained. And Ed knew who I was. And he said, huh. So he said, okay, we'll have a women's division. I don't remember how many women were there, but he paid my airfare. Ed, I loved Ed. He was great. So he paid my airfare to come because he wanted me to be there. And I did get second place of the women, and that was great. Cynthia Allen won. I think she beat me by one stroke. So I was close. But that was a big deal to get a women's division when it wasn't planned and they didn't want to do it. So I decided to start a women's frisbee organization, and we started it at the 78 Rose Bowl. All the women that were there, we had a big meeting and said, hey, we're going to start a women's flying disc organization. And we called it FLO, Flying Disc League of Women. And Monica Liu designed our first and only disc. And it was on a 165. It was beautiful. And so our goal was to have a network of all of us at our homes, wherever they were. And we were to help tournament directors try to encourage more women to come and teach them how to do that, because what was happening wasn't quite working. And so I said, you got to give trophies to all of them. You got to give them prize money, just like you do to the men, or they're not going to come, you know? So we did that for a couple years and, you know, and all of a sudden it kind of blossomed and there was a lot more women playing and women were happier. And it kind of, you know, when I got out of playing and was having kids and stuff, it kind of just died down. But it seems like it performed its function of, you know, now I don't know how many women, there's a lot of women playing frisbee. So everywhere you go, you see them. There's women's ultimate teams. You know, back when we were playing, it was only the men. So they would have the, you know, ultimate championships and it was just men only. I was the only woman who played because I was on the Olympic Windjammers. So we went down to the Western Nationals. And as far as I know, I might be the first woman to score a goal there because I was the only one there and I was on a men's team. Because when I caught it, all these guys on my team came down and go, hey, you just became the first woman to score a goal at the Western Nationals. And I was like, really? And they go, well, look around. I go, oh, yeah. I mean, I was used to it. So, you know, but I mean, I don't know how to prove that I was, but that's just what, you know, we surmised at the time. So then, yeah. You know. The Santa Barbara Condors women's team was probably the best one in the beginning when women's teams were playing. And Dark Star, Eugene, they had good team too. And then some of my friends played on teams here. And then it just went crazy and, you know, blossomed. I mean, Ultimate's big. There's professional Ultimate and professional golf. Yeah. And it's just like, I'm just surprised how it happened so quickly. I mean, I didn't envision it would be this fast.
Yeah.
Like how much money the top Frisbee golf or disc golfers are making now. We didn't make anything, you know?
Yeah.
We got a trophy if we were lucky. Sometimes we didn't. But I mean, we did it because it was fun and we encouraged everyone else. It was, you know, it was just what we did. It was a different feeling. Like when I went to Nationals 4 years ago, it was a big production and there's these big flags flying everywhere. And there's, you know, men helping carry women's discs on their rounds. And I'm like, really? Like we carried our own, you know, but there's all these helpers and assistants and it's like a big, huge production of, you know, tournament people that work at those tournaments. And the organization, it's just, and sponsors, and they have interviews, and they do things like this on the internet, and they, I mean, so we didn't have any of that, so.
That's what's great. Yeah. So we're about time to wrap it up, and
okay,
I'm honestly, my eyes are starting to water a little bit because the sport that so many of us enjoy and so many of us love, it was built on the backs of the real pioneers of the game, you know, and that started, you know, it really started in the 70s. And there were some companies like WAMO involved, obviously, but the vast majority of people did it for decades for just pure love. And people like me were able to start making a living on that, at playing this sport in the 90s. Because of people like you and people like Paige Pierce and Katrina Allen and Sarah Hokum. And I mean, the list goes on. The women's field exists on the backs of players like you. And so, you know, there's a legacy that you've left behind. And so I hope you look at the sport like another one of your children, because you helped, you helped raise this and set it off. And then you set it off to the world and went on to do your life for a while. And I'm so glad you're back in the game. And but just thank you from all of us who get to enjoy the sport. Thank you, and you know all the unnamed people that we'll never get to thank. But it's really an honor.
Sure,
you are one of my heroes.
Oh well, thank you, and it's been a pleasure. And I have lots more stories, but you know another time.
Yeah. Well, we're gonna do. I plan on doing this every week for a long time. And so, you know, we're going to do a history of disc golf in the women's division. I mean, we're going to come back around, and I hope to see you in Cedro Woolley in a couple weeks, because we're going to be so close to you.
It would be lovely. What weekend is that? Okay. All right.
Let's see. The 7th and 8th, the 14th and 13th, 14th or 14th and 15th of July. It's at pga.com. golfscene.com.
Okay.
But other than that, I thank you so much for adapting, because this is not what we intended when we started. But
I know, I'm sorry my other two buddies couldn't make it, but it's been a pleasure. And good luck to you on all the rest of them.
Thank you.
I'm sure I could talk so another hour, but
oh, for sure. So I love it. Well, I hope to see you in a couple weeks. Thank you, and then we'll. I'm sure everybody's going to absolutely love this. All right, it's great talking to you.
Bye, everybody. Okay,
bye.